Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Griefsters. How are you? Yeah, how are you today, I should say. I hope you're okay wherever you're listening in the world and whatever continuing madness you're having to deal with at the moment. I hope it's bearable today. Thank you so much for your lovely comments and messages and emails. We're at the Griefcast on Twitter and Instagram and all the lovely comments you leave under the videos. It's wonderful. I'm so glad you're enjoying this series. I really appreciate it because, it's not easy to continue doing this in a pandemic. So I'm glad you enjoy it. If you have been enjoying it, you know, I know everyone else, but please do rate, review and subscribe the podcast. It does genuinely help me to continue making it. And if you've done it already, thank you very much. This week, I am talking to the incredibly talented Governor B. He is a rapper, a writer, an author, a musician. He is the two-time Mobo award-winning artist. He's a brand new book that came out in February called Unspoken, Toxic Masculinity, How I Face the Man Within the Man, that covers an array of topics, including grief, but as well as male identity, fatherhood, and overcoming the unexpected. Isaac came in to talk to me about his dad, who passed away from T-cell lymphoma 3.5 years ago. We're currently, as we're speaking this, we're sort of at the end of lockdown 3. How is your current lockdown status? Is it okay?
Yeah, I'd say 5 out of 10, maybe. Ooh. It's probably the toughest lockdown.
Ooh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite good at adapting. So, you know, the first couple, I was like, right, get on with it, you know, new season. But now I'm just like, okay, I've had enough now.
And your book, Unspoken, came out this year? Yes, this year. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, it came out in February 2021.
How was that, having a book launch in this sort of madness?
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, obviously you didn't get the opportunity to go into Waterstones and see it in the window. Yeah. And all that kind of stuff. You know, picture moment, and mum couldn't go in and stuff. But I think it's, you know, the positive's been everyone's been at home. And so people are probably reading a lot more because they have time to. So. Yeah, I guess that's a positive.
Yeah, it's weird though, isn't it? To sort of, there is always positives to these things, as we always say on the show, you know, with anything problematic. But it's like properly bittersweet at the moment, isn't it? It's just like, oh, that is good that they have time to read, but I would like to go into a shop.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like bittersweet has been the theme of my life for like the last 3-4 years. Like nothing is fully enjoyable anymore, which is kind of sad, but yeah.
So, Isaac, who are we remembering today?
We're remembering my dad, father,
your dad.
Old man.
What was his name?
Charles.
Charles.
Yeah.
What's your surname, if you mind me asking? Because it's not.
My surname's Borkwe. So my dad's Ghanaian. His full name is Charles Nibwe Borkwe.
That's an elegant name. I like that name a lot.
Yeah, it's a good name. And my middle name is Charles. So I got named after him, which is cool.
That's lovely. So how long ago did Charles die?
3.5 years ago. It was July 2017.
And so what happened? What did he die of?
So he died of something called T-cell lymphoma, which is a cancer of the blood. He didn't know that he had it, and so it was quite sudden. By the time he was feeling really ill, he went into hospital, and then they kept him in, and 4 days later, he had passed away.
Oh, my God.
Which actually does... If I had to think about a way that my dad would pass, it would probably be that, because he was so hardworking, never really spoke about how he was feeling. If he was ill, he'd never want to go to the hospital. And so, yeah, he was probably feeling quite, you know, lethargic, but just put it down to, oh, maybe I'm working a bit, I'll just have a good sleep. But yeah, he didn't know he had it, so it was quite quick.
Blimey, so up until that point, there was no sort of hint or symptom that it was like, oh, it's so bad he has to go to hospital.
Well, about 20 years ago, it was actually 20 years to the day that he passed away, he had open heart surgery. And the result of that was he had to be on medication for life, basically. And so he'd go through seasons of life where he was feeling under the weather. But I think he'd just put it down to, oh, need to up my dosage or lower my dosage and that kind of stuff. But in terms of, you know, noticing that something was seriously wrong, yeah, there was no indication. At least he didn't show that there was any indication.
So weird, isn't it, how, like, after someone dies, you know, suddenly all those months and days, suddenly, you know, you start looking at them with a magnifying glass, don't you? I know with... So my dad was diagnosed in February, and maybe like a year ago, something like that, I found a picture. And you know those old pictures used to have the date stamp on? I'm talking, like, old school physical picture. And it was a picture from the November of the year before. And I was like, oh, he must have had cancer then. But it was like seeing this picture and being like, oh, he looks really ill. Like, nobody, again, like, my dad worked all the time. So it was like, oh, we probably just thought he was tired and working too hard. And it's so weird, isn't it, to think, God, when, you know, you start questioning, when did they have it? What did they know? But it just doesn't show in people. You don't get enough time. And I think that happens with blood cancer as well sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, in my experience, yeah. And also I think it depends on, you know, the personality of the person we're talking about, because my dad was a man of few words. And so, you know, looking at him and how he behaved, there wasn't really a difference to how he normally is. And so it would have probably been quite hard to tell.
Yeah. I can understand. So Where were you when you sort of heard he was in hospital? Were you able to go to the hospital and see him?
Yeah, so I actually went to my parents' house because my mum had noticed a lump on his neck. And my mum's really good with noticing stuff. So she was kind of like, right, Charles, we need to go to the hospital. Mm. And my dad was like, no, I'm fine. And he started to breathe quite heavily in his sleep. And so she told me to come over. I went over and saw him. And I knew that he wasn't 100%. And I think deep down I was worried. But because my mum suffers from anxiety quite a lot, I wanted to reassure her. But then I said to my dad, you should probably get that checked out. And so he went to the hospital the next day and I went along to visit him. He was actually okay the first day I visited him. And they kept him in overnight, went back the second day. And I remember walking in and, you know, had all these tubes and stuff. And my heart just dropped. Because I was like, ah, there's actually something wrong. This doesn't look too good. And I got really emotional. Before that, I hadn't cried for a long, long time. But yeah, I think inside I knew something's not right here. But the next day, he was looking a bit better. The doctors were trying to find out what it was. They didn't know at that point, and they were a bit more optimistic. But when I went to visit him, it was my wife's birthday as well. So we were going out in the evening, and I said, look, I'm happy not to go, I want to stay. And he was like, no, go. And I was like, all right, cool. And then as I was leaving, he said, I love you. And he never, ever told me he loved me. I knew he did, but he just wasn't that kind of guy, you know? And then I said, I love you too. And I was like, oh, that was so strange. Like, why did he say that? like, he must know something's up.
Wow.
And then, yeah, we went out for my wife's birthday, got back home, and 2 a.m. I got a call from my brother saying the hospital's asked us to come in and see my dad. And, yeah, he had passed a few hours later.
Did you get to the hospital in time to see him, or was he sort of too ill by then?
Yeah, I got to the hospital in time to see him, but he wasn't there. He was, you know, induced, not fully conscious.
How incredible that he said that to you. That is...
It's a miracle. Like, knowing my dad, I can't remember the last time he said that to me. I don't think he's ever... Maybe once, I remember. But yeah, it was... I'm so thankful for that moment.
That's amazing.
I know it would have taken a lot for him to, you know, even utter those words. So yeah, thanks, Dad.
God, that's so, I mean, especially when it's so fast as well, you know, like when something, like you said, 4 days ago, someone's up and saying, no, I'm fine, don't worry about it, to being like all tubed up and, oh no, this is really bad, actually, we can't, you know, they're not there. For him to, like you said, to find the strength to say that, yeah, you just have to be grateful for those moments, I suppose, don't you? Just have to be like, I'm glad that happened. Even though it's so, like you said, so bittersweet, it's surrounded by all this pain, but there's this little bit of love that came through.
Yeah, and I'm super grateful for that. Obviously, you get the, you know, what if I had noticed earlier and what if he was struggling with it but didn't tell anyone? What if the doctors could have done something if they knew it was T-cell lymphoma when he first came in? And those kind of things are quite hard to grapple with. And I wouldn't say I'm completely out at the end of the tunnel, but yeah, it's definitely a journey of trying to not let it get to me.
How have you dealt with that over the past 3.5 years of those questions that, you know, that I know a lot of listeners talk about that, those early questions that just keep coming over, what if, like, how have you personally found a way to kind of, like you said, find a peace with that?
Not very well is the answer.
It's so hard.
Yeah. I think one thing that's, you know, really helped me in terms of, you know, my mentality and how I look at it is to try and make it not seem as serious as it is. Because I think if, you know, the seriousness of it all clouds my mind, it just becomes a bit overwhelming. So me and my brother always kind of laugh about the funny things that happened after he passed, just with family and stuff, because that makes it a bit easier for us. It's kind of like your icebreaker into talking about it. So one thing I always laugh about is basically when my mum found out that he had passed away, she fainted, and then, you know, she was all right, we said goodbye and stuff, and then we got into the car once we were leaving the hospital, and one of my aunties that it's one that, you know, everyone's got this annoying auntie that no one really likes, but she's there. She wanted to get in the car to get a lift back to our house. And my mum was like completely out of it and distraught, but she still had enough of a sound mind to pinch me when my auntie was asking for a lift to kind of signal, don't you dare let her get in our car. So thinking about things like that make it easier for me to process. And I guess when I'm in the frame of mind that, okay, I can think about this now, it's kind of practicing vulnerability and honesty with the people in my life that have consistently been there for me and shown me that they love me. Because I was, you know, conditioned from a very young age that, you know, being the eldest child, the first generation Brit, born to Ghanaian parents, growing up on a council estate, you shouldn't be vulnerable, because we don't have time for you to be a victim or vulnerable. We have to, you know, further the legacy of the family that left everything they had in Ghana to come over to England, and you don't cry on the estate because you might become a victim and all that kind of stuff. And I tried to do all of it when my dad passed, but I think I reached mental capacity and I ended up breaking down in floods of tears by myself on a beach in California. But the weird thing about it is after I'd finished crying, I felt a freedom that I hadn't felt in a long, long time. And I guess that was, you know, the pathway into me practicing vulnerability with the people around me. So it was a good thing in the end, I guess.
Was that the first time you'd kind of really cried for him? Did you kind of keep it together at the funeral and all of that, like after little bit?
Yeah, that was the first, like, you know, ugly cry. Yeah. Like,
did you get that point when you're like, who's making that noise?
Yeah.
It's me. Oh my God. It's I made that noise.
Me. Yeah,
it's you think an animal has just passed you. It's yeah, me. Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at the funeral, I like to think of it as a little thug cry, you know, a little one tear. But yeah, that was the first time on the beach where I just completely let myself go.
And how long was that after his death?
3 months.
Yeah. I think as well, because you had such a quick, you know, from diagnosis to death, like, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing at all. And yeah, I always think mine was quite quick because he was diagnosed in February, dead by April. But like 4 days is no time. And it's interesting because I've spoken to people who've lost parents to like heart attack or something, like instant, and they are in such shock. And I wonder if like, did you give yourself space to be in shock? Because you must have been in shock for the first 3 months of it. Just like, what just happened? He was just here.
Yeah, I didn't give myself space at all. I think I embraced the responsibility of being the eldest child and making sure my mum was okay and my brother was okay and the funeral arrangements were all sorted and everyone that was coming knew what was happening and the will and all that kind of stuff. It was actually quite nice for me, if I'm being honest, because I didn't want to face myself, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was helpful, but I think I kind of missed the shock stage or ignored it maybe, and so it makes sense why, you know, 3 months later I'm just breaking down as if it happened that very day.
Oh, I'm not surprised at all, and that's so common with the admin. Like, it's so common for someone, and it's not always the oldest. It's like some sibling, aunt, uncle is like, I'm gonna do all the admin, and everyone's like, oh, that's good. And you can see that person is like, hooray, admin, I don't have to think, admin. Like,
yeah.
It makes perfect sense because it makes you feel in control. It makes you feel like you're being useful. And death takes all those things away from you. You know, death makes you feel like you have no control. You're not useful. There's nothing you can do. The world is just deciding things for you. So I think that's so common to find comfort in the, you know, I booked a thing, it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's so true what you say about, you know, death taking away the control, because I have a lot of pride. It's probably quite selfish. Like, I like being the hero in my relationships, the guy that, you know, shoulders everyone's problems and looks after everyone. And this was the first time that I can't control what is happening, what's going on. And so it was actually really, really humbling that I couldn't be king of my castle at that point.
It's, I think humbling's a really good word. It really is. It's like, because it's just no arguing with death. Like, especially I think maybe if you're good with words as well, like if you're used to like getting yourself out of situations or negotiating or good at communication, like you have this, you know, gift of the gab, this skill, which obviously you do as a writer and a rapper. And death just is like, doesn't care. Like,
yeah.
You're like, there's no, and you're so, I've definitely felt, I was like looking for this way that I could like somehow renegotiate the deal. I'd be like, can I just, sorry, I feel like I signed too early. Let's talk about this.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
That was me when, you know, after he had passed and, you know, the doctor comes in. No, we went for a meeting a few days after, because that's when his test results came back and they found out it was cancer. And I'm in that room with the doctor trying to negotiate, almost like he can bring him back. Like, wait, so you didn't know it was, could you have done anything? And I'm there for an hour just chatting to this guy and I'm like, right, Isaac, you just need to realize your dad's gone and nothing's going to bring him back.
But so hard. I mean, it takes years to accept that, to realize it. So when you were on that beach in California, were you working in California?
Yeah, I was doing a tour in America.
Wow.
And that was the last day of the tour, actually. So up until that point, it was, you know, eldest child, admin, funeral, etc. Then straight into work, shows, meeting people. And then I think California, that beach, it was just my first time alone with nothing to do and just space to process.
We say this all the time in the show, of like, grief just waits. Just wait. It's not, and it's, I keep coming back to this, like, it's not malevolent, it's not like waiting for you like a monster, but it just really patiently waits. And I can't believe that you, I can believe, because I know this is how we all cope with it, like to have to go back to performing and being on stage and giving that to the audience and being like, everything's fine. Like, yeah, I'm not surprised that when you finally sat alone faced with the Pacific Ocean, you were like, oh my God, what just happened? Like,
yeah, yeah. And it almost felt like it was the first time I had switched off in years, because when I was 15, one of my friends was murdered on our estate, and just, you know, being on the estate and that kind of stuff happening, not like super often, but every now and again, there's like a glamorization that comes with it and that kind of stuff, and everyone's really upset, but we do suppress it as like young men and life goes on. But it felt like when I was crying on that beach, I wasn't just crying for my dad. I was letting out all the trauma that I've ever been through in life and never dealt with. So it was almost like the grief from my 15-year-old experiences were also coming out in that moment. And yeah, it just felt like the first time I'd really switched off for a long, long time.
I think it's, I mean, you know, my dad died when I was 15, and I think it's so easy as teenagers to just like sort of, I can never say this word, compartmentalise things. And like you said, yeah, I mean, to even say that sentence, like, it wasn't super common, but it did happen. It's like, that's a huge thing for teenagers to get their head around, like their friends might die, and that's scary. And to lose a friend in really traumatic circumstances, like a murder, you know, there must have been so much going on in that 15-year-old brain that perhaps, like you said, until your dad passed, like, all these things are just sort of are waiting, aren't they? Just sort of patiently, like, when he's ready,
yeah,
we're here.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think, you know, no matter how young you are, as soon as you lose someone relatively close to you, it becomes, you know, a mental health issue for you and everyone connected to that person. But I think what made it really hard is culturally, you know, having Ghanaian parents, stuff like, you know, dealing with your emotions and counselling and grieving properly, it's like, it's quite taboo. My parents were Christians as well, so they almost have the view that if you've got God, then you don't need to do anything else. He'll look after everything. Yeah. And that just wasn't my reality. And so I think, yeah, culturally, the whole looking after your emotion stuff being taboo made me suppress it even more.
Yeah, that's hard, isn't it? It's a sort of double whammy of, like you said, the culture you were brought up in, being a young man, and also, yeah, on Christianity, which, you know, obviously people have faith in it, is so, it guides them and helps them and brings them joy. But there is an attitude of death is a good thing because you're going to the better place, which I think when you're grieving is quite hard to get your head around, because you're like, so we're happy this happened?
Like, yeah, that was a big thing for me though. Like, you know, being a Christian myself and just having that perspective. Because I always remember when we got to the hospital, there was a family. My mind wasn't in the right place. And I remember this because the ward that we went into was the high dependency unit, and it just said HDU, but I just thought, oh, like, it must be fine. Like, do you know what I mean? But there was a family out there crying, just like distraught because they had just lost someone. And obviously that was me about half an hour later. But then, like, when I think about, you know, faith and the idea of heaven and my dad being in a better place, I think, okay, every Father's Day or every birthday that goes past, I normally get really sad because it feels like he's getting further and further away.
Yeah.
But if I change my perspective, I'm actually getting closer and closer to seeing him again, which is cool. And then I think back to the family and I'm like, oh, I really wish, like, they've got some kind of hope, or I hope they've got something to cling on to. Otherwise, that's kind of where it ends, which is really, really sad. And so I am thankful for, you know, faith, but I just don't like when it becomes, when it's used as, you know, something that is detrimental to your mental health.
Yeah, so I'm not a Christian, but I was raised, you know, old lazy Church of England. So, yeah. Like,
come I know by what, my Lord, come
and also with you, I know what to say. But yeah, and I think it's a great comfort. I can see how much of it is as a comfort. And there's definitely times when, as someone who's not a Christian, you think, oh God, I've be nice to, like, you're like, you look at them and you're like, no, they do look like they're having a good time, like, because they've got this belief that they are gonna, that heaven exists and there is this better place. But yeah, I understand what you're saying about it being detrimental, and I think definitely because of, you know, I had well-meaning Christian people around who would be like, well, you know, he's gone to a better place. And I remember as a teenager just being like, what the fuck, like, what does that mean? Like, because it's so it's just very hard to get your head around. And I think that is a thing with faith and grief. You really have to, if you do believe in faith, you have to really grapple with some really big things to have that belief. It's not an an easy choice, I think, sometimes, if you're going to be like, no, I thought about this. So
you do. And I think, you know, if you have faith, it's unique to you. So you should be given that space to work it out for yourself. Because I had loads of, you know, friends and family members saying the same thing. He's gone to a better place. Don't worry, it'll be all right. And I'm like, I don't feel like that right now. Mm. Like, I understand you mean well, but can you stop talking to me, please? You're pissing me off.
Well, yeah, I think also what it does, it seems to, that when you say that to, especially like a grieving child, it seems to jump the bit where there's grief of like, he's gone to a better place. It's like, if you have faith, yes, he has gone to a better place, but can I be sad before we jump to everything's fine? Because it's kind of, there's kind of a sweeping of emotion. It kind of, the subtext is, so don't be sad because he's fine. You're like, but you can still be, you know, you can still have faith and believe in heaven and all of those things and be sad that someone isn't here. That's, that 100%. There needs to be space for that as well.
Yeah.
So when you were on that beach and you had that breakdown, sorry, so you said breakdown. I just given you a breakdown. And when you were crying, did you feel like everything changed in that moment, or did you feel it was like that was the starting point of more gradual changes? And like, what was your process of, like you said, being more vulnerable with your grief?
Yeah, no, that was definitely the starting point. That was me realizing, oh my gosh, I've been doing 27 years of life completely wrong and viewing my masculinity in the wrong way. And, you know, actually, all the things I was taught make a strong man, you know, like never crying and dominance and that kind of stuff. Like, they're good things in of themselves, but when my mind and my body's telling me, no, be vulnerable, I have to listen. And actually, it takes like a lot of bravery to, cry and be vulnerable and be honest. Like, going to the gym and, you know, that kind of stuff, like... cool, just not hard though. It's not like brave. Do you know what I mean?
It takes effort, but it doesn't. Yeah, it does. It's not. You're not vulnerable doing it. Like, you've got to be like, I got up at 7. I went to the gym. Well done. Yeah. But yeah, to cry in front of someone is like, that is actually very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that was the start of trying to recalibrate my brain, and failing the first few months probably. And it wasn't until my wife had enough of me hiding away, drinking too much alcohol, trying to numb the pain and get to sleep and that kind of stuff, that she said, right, she said, I've googled, is my husband grieving or just being really annoying? And I think you're being really annoying, so we're getting into marriage counselling. Oh, crap. So yeah.
Sorry. That's amazing. That's amazing. Good on your wife. What an incredible way to deal with it.
Yeah, fair play. but yeah, we went counselling and it was the first time I'd been, and yeah, it was great for me. You know, I spoke about stuff that I hadn't really spoken about before, and that was definitely like a huge part of me starting this journey to, you know, vulnerability and honesty and embracing how I feel.
That's amazing. So my husband lost his father, I think when he was... in his 20s, and I was obviously, I got that, got a dead dad, I was there, I could deal with it. And then he lost his mum a few years after that, and he was much closer to his mum, and it was a really, really difficult grief. And it was the first time I was like, oh, I don't feel equipped, like I suddenly don't know what to do. And I'm like, we had similar conversations where it's like, you're being very sympathetic, you understand grief, you know this is very painful, but you've reached the point where you're like, I just think this has tipped into not grief, but just being annoying. And it's that is impressive that she said it, and impressive that you listened and didn't just go, oh, like, no, you're wrong, I'm gonna have another drink and shut up.
No, I definitely made it sound a lot better than I made myself sound a lot better than the actual conversation.
I remember similar with my husband, lots of, you know, chats about counselling. And I was brought up in a really, like, sort of counselling friendly household. Like, they're quite, my parents were very hippies, and there was lots of therapy talk. And he didn't have that. And he found it really, like, even the idea of going to counselling for him was really, like, it took a long while to get his head in a place where it's like, oh, okay, I can go into a room and speak to someone. Whereas I didn't have any problem going and talking about it. I just found it difficult to find the right person, but I was like, so ready to talk. I was like, sure. Like, when my GP was like, do you think you should have therapy? I was like, oh my God, yes, yes, come on, where? And he said it really tentatively, like, oh, this could offend her. I was like, no, I'm so ready. I just can't find the right person. So you did the marriage counselling, but did you sort of end up focusing on the grief in those sessions?
Yeah, so I started to go counselling by myself. Mm. I had to try a few different counsellors. The first one I quite liked, but after the third session, it was kind of like, I actually don't like talking to you that much. So I might try and find someone else. But the second person was great.
I say this all the time about counselling, like, because so many people say to me, oh, I tried it, I didn't like it. And I'm like, it's like relationships. You wouldn't literally like have your first, you know, school boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, and be like, well, I went on 2 dates, I'll never do that again. Yeah. You're like, oh, you're not right. But with counsellors or therapists, it's like, you've got to find the right one. I had some terrible, really bad, like, tryouts. Mm. And then I would give up for like a year. And then I would look again. And then eventually I found someone who was just so brilliant and so exactly what I needed. But it's like, you need to be in the right place. They need to be in the right place. It's like, you know, it's such a little...
Yeah.
The word, the karma, everything has to come together. But I think that's amazing that you tried it and then immediately found someone else. Because so many people do get put off and they just think, oh, it's not for me, rather than that person's not for me.
Yeah, I was definitely put off, I think. And there was a few months, you know, gap between me finding another one. And I think, you know, having my son was the real push, because it gave me another reason to be better, because mm-hmm. I realized that, you know, my dad was great, but a lot of the stuff that he didn't do so well, I subconsciously picked up. I think you can go mm-hmm. two ways. You can be like, right, my dad didn't do this, and so I'm going to be the best at it. Or you can go, oh, I'm just going to be the same. And that was me. But yeah, I think having my son was like, okay, sort yourself out and try and equip yourself with the tools that give you the best chance to do so.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. I think, yeah, having kids is a big factor, isn't it? And in looking at your own parents, and especially... So was your dad... No, your dad wasn't alive when you had your son.
No, he wasn't. So I had my son in 2019. It's 2 years after.
And that's hard in itself. How did you find that moment when you're like, oh, I'm a dad and he's not here for me to have those questions or share that moment?
Yeah, it was, you know, what we were talking about with it being bittersweet. Mm-hmm. After he passed, I put out an album that did quite well, was able to buy a house. And I was like, oh my gosh, got my first house. Then it was like, oh crap, dad's not here to see it. And this is basically what he worked to see me do. And it was like, yay, baby. And I was like, oh, granddad's not here. You know? But yeah, I don't know. I'm still working it out, but I just try and take the rough with the smooth.
Yeah,
be all there.
It's really hard, and you know, obviously I've spoken to so many people, and I think that I remember specifically talking to Felix White, you know, who was in the Maccabees.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, said a really similar thing of like, you know, playing this massive concert and like the whole crowd is singing about your lyrics, but you're like, oh, they're not, they'll never know. I can't tell them. I can't tell them about this. And I think, yeah, bittersweet is annoyingly such a good word for it, because everything is, yeah, it's weird for me, obviously, because I've been living that life for so long. So I've had so many moments, like, you know, my GCSEs, my A-levels going, like all these moments of my life. So I've kind of got used to it. And I think it does get a bit easier. I think it doesn't sting as much. You know what I mean? Like the cut isn't like as raw, but you still have a moment of like, that's annoying.
I'd agree. I feel like the bittersweet feeling is a bit different. So when he had first passed and I was doing shows, I'd be on stage or just have got off stage and then I thought, oh man, I'm still feeling it, like Dad's not here. But now I find that I can actually enjoy the moment a lot more. It'll still hit me at some point, might be a week later or whatever, but I find that I'm probably better at enjoying the moment and living in the moment now. And it doesn't hit as, you know, as hard or as soon after that moment.
That's good. I mean, that's progress. I mean, and not, you know, grief isn't something you get over. It isn't something that magically disappears. But I think all that happens is you recognize the feelings. So like, you're like, oh, it's this one. Okay. What do I need to do? I want to enjoy this. So let's have that feeling a bit later, or let's hope that feeling comes when I'm at home and I'm not on stage. And
yeah,
that's all you can do really is when they pop their head up, be like, oh, you, okay.
That's good, yeah. Like, I wish that I knew when it was coming. Because, last Father's Day, right, day before, doing all right, I'm feeling good. I'm like, oh, this is new. I think I'm doing well, yeah? I wake up in the morning and, oh, my days, like, this wave of emotion just hits me. And I'm like, where the hell has this come from? I was doing all right. And I'm like, oh, I wish I knew it was coming. I would have felt a bit better.
I completely agree. That's what I think is also weird, that you can go to bed quite philosophical. And I'll be saying to myself, I'm all right and it's fine and this thing happened. These things happen. And you're all like, cool. And yeah, you wake up and you're like it's like you went to bed and you ate something. You're like, what's that? What did I drink? Or, oh, yuck. Oh, it's Greek. Oh. And you're like, I don't remember doing that. I don't remember. Yeah, it would be really good if there was more warning.
Yeah.
I think I've got slightly better. And this is like 20 years.
Oh, great. I've got a lot to look forward to.
Mate, let me tell you, it's a roller coaster. I've got slightly better at sensing it coming, but you're not always right. But I have got slightly better at, like, if I'm in what I think is a fine mood, and then sometimes I think, is it fine or are you on edge? And you're sort of like, oh, if I'm being a bit manic, a bit like, everything's fine, I'm doing loads. I think, God, look at me getting stuff done. I'm doing so much stuff. I'm so good. I'm like burning through things. And I think, why are you doing so much? Like, why haven't you sat down today? Yeah. Is everything all right? But it's hard. Like, you have to kind of, like you said, it's being present, isn't it? It's really hard. It's like not something you can not practice. Like, you have to practice it and be like, okay, what is this? But yeah, that emotion of grief is really hard. And stuff like Father's Day and birthdays and Christmases. And I mean, I don't know about you. That's what annoyed me. One of the things that annoyed me was like, you think it's just going to be the anniversary. And then there's this whole, you're joking. All these other days are going to bother me as well. Like, oh God, there's a lot of days in the year that I'm having to prep myself for.
Yeah. But this is quite morbid, yeah.
Go for it.
But even though it's difficult, those days, I kind of like it, because I don't want to ever forget that I miss you. Like, I don't want you to ever become a distant memory. So I'm like, yeah, I hate the feeling, but then in some ways I'm glad I have, you know, those feelings and those ways to remember how much of a big part of my life he still is, you know?
I totally understand that. And I've definitely had, because I'm so further down the line, I do feel sometimes guilty of like, oh, I don't miss you in the same way. I don't have that like, oh my God, I can't, it's so painful. I'll have like, oh, it hurts, but yeah, it's okay. Sometimes, obviously, you still get the shit days. But yeah, I do know that feeling of sort of being still, I guess, connected to them in a way, isn't it? Still connected to their presence kind of thing.
That actually happened to me the other day. Wait, you know, like people say stuff like, oh yeah, I think of you every single day since I lost you and stuff like that. I'm like, oh yeah, cool. And then I had this day, it must have been 3 weeks ago. I'm like, oh, I didn't think about my dad yesterday. I actually feel really guilty. So then I put on one of his favourite CDs to make myself really sad. Like, hopefully I've made up for it.
See, Dad, look what I'm doing now. I'm being really sad.
Yeah,
I think I definitely have days, despite doing this podcast, I have days where I don't think about him, definitely, which I think, you know, after a certain amount of time, you know, you've moved on so much in your life. And I did used to feel a bit more guilty about it. I think that, you know, when it's like you're going through a phase, so that first year into that second year into that third year, and like when you're sort of like in year 15, you're like, oh, I think I'm changing again into something else. Like, this grief is now moving into this. And that's always hard, that transition moment when you're like, oh, it feels like the grief is really moving. And I think that can be a bit like, oh, a bit shaky.
Yeah.
So you're coming up to your fourth year then soon, anniversary, yeah.
Fourth in July, yeah.
In July. How are you feeling about that number and that time? Especially, I mean, at the moment it's tricky because of lockdown and stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day. It's a weird feeling. I think second year especially was like, this is still really fresh. Third year, oh, I can't believe it's 3 years. Fourth year, yeah. I'm like, no, there's no way it could be 4 years. Like, it still feels like yesterday. And so much has happened since, you know. So at the moment, I'm actually feeling okay. I'm feeling like I've moved on from the worst parts of me. Just, you know, chatting to friends and stuff. A lot of them said, oh, you acted really out of character when, you know, your dad passed. But I kind of view it differently. I think I've had quite a blessed life. Like, I've been fortunate, even though, you know, we didn't have much money growing up and stuff like that. Had family that loved me and good people around and that kind of stuff. So it's quite easy for me to, you know, show the good parts of myself and, like, be a decent person and that kind of stuff. But I think when life isn't going my way, that's when almost like my true character comes out, you know, and rears its head. So, you know, my addiction to alcohol during that period, I'm thankfully over, and think I have healthier relationships with, you know, my wife and my mum and, you know, people in my life. So it feels like, you know, that first kind of initial reaction of, crap, my whole life's changed. I feel like I've moved a little bit forward from that point. And now it's just like, ah, still hurts, but life, what else have you got to give me? And how can I respond in the best way and learn from this? I don't know what this stage is, but I just know that I feel like I'm not in the same place I was in the first couple of years.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? Because there's no like clear date line on anything. And I think you just get a sense sometimes, like the wind changes and you're like, oh, I feel differently about that memory or that, you know, shirt I've seen. Like, suddenly it's like things are not like, you're not bursting into tears over everything, you know, so you're like, oh, okay. And it sort of just subtly happens or changes. And I think that's interesting what you say about like your true self, because I suppose I always think when things don't get your own way, when things don't go one's own way, it's not necessarily your true self. It's like, I would say, like, that sounds quite harsh on you.
Yeah.
Like, it's more like yourself under pressure. And like, we none of us know how we're going to react under like that. Like, I mean, like, lockdown's a perfect example, isn't it? Like, you never know quite how you're going to react when things are incredibly stressful. And you might have this idea of yourself, oh, I'll be this and I'll be this. And then shit hits the fan and you're like, oh,
yeah,
I'm actually not very cool in these situations. I'm actually quite stressed.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely tough on myself. And it's because in that period, you know, everyone thinks about the person that's lost someone really close to them, but they don't always think about, you know, all the other people they're connected to that they might be hurting from, you know, internalizing grief or just dealing with it in a way that's, you know, affects everyone. Because it's tough for me, you know, and I think because I put, you know, a lot of people around me in, I don't know, I put them through a bit of pain with the way I responded, and I felt like I didn't truly take responsibility in that period. And so now I feel like I'm harsher on myself to make up for it. And it's always a challenge to try and be kind to myself. That's what I say about art. It revealed my true character. Because really, I don't really think I'm like a bad person.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm not, but yeah.
I understand that. And I definitely got better at looking back at that person who was grieving and just feeling kindness. But it took a long time because I definitely, like, you have all the rage. And then I said, you're moving the stage and you're like, oh, I was a right pain in the arse. Oh, no. And then I sort of ignored it for ages. And that now I think I can look back and I think, I mean, obviously, I don't know, but maybe in more years' time, you'll look back at that, Isaac, and be like, well, he was 27. You know, your dad died within 4. Like, that is so much to deal with. Who wouldn't have a dodgy patch and use alcohol to numb pain? But you also sound incredibly self-aware. And I think that's the key, is like, no human is perfect. We all make these really terrible choices through our life. And all you can do is kind of go, that was, hands up, that was a bad choice. And so many people don't. They're like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. And that is the painful thing, really. I think we can relate as humans to people being in pain and see their actions. And the pain you feel really is like, I love you, I don't want you to hurt yourself. But if somebody can be self-aware enough to go, yeah, you're right, I'm being a pain, I'm going to stop doing that. And that's such a healing part of the process.
Yeah, no, for sure. Do you do counselling sessions? I might come to you instead. No, you're right. And I think for me, it's encouraging to, you know, speak to someone that's ahead of the journey by a number of years and able to look back at themselves in a way that's kinder, you know, and hopefully I can get to that point as well.
Oh, but I mean, this took time and therapy, like a lot of therapy. And I didn't have it for years because I said I was a teenager. So I just was like, oh, I don't know how to do this process. And it took, yeah, it took a lot of therapy for me to realize how harsh I was on the girl that had lost a parent. And I think also the other thing that's good that happens is as you get older, you meet people younger. So if you meet someone who's 27, you will look at them and go, you're so young. Yeah. But when you're 27, you think, oh, I know everything. I'm an adult. When I was 15, I thought, oh, I was pretty grown up. And it wasn't until I got, you know, much, much older and I could meet a 15-year-old. And I was like, you're a baby. You're just a literal baby. But to head, and that, you know, I think we, you know, you have that experience whether you've lost someone or not. But when you have and you can meet someone, especially if you meet someone like who like looks like you or is from your area and they're talking, you're like, that's what I looked like when I was convinced that I was this grown up that knew what was going on. And you as the adult are like, oh my God, this kid knows nothing. Like,
yeah, for sure, man. I have those moments every now and again. I love the way you talk about yourself when you were 15 as, you know, the girl that was grieving. I've never actually done that, but I just literally thought about it. And I was like, oh, the guy that was grieving 3 years ago, like, I'm able to be a bit more kinder and think about, you know, that person wasn't fully me. Mm. He was responding to something that made him act a bit out of character, turn to things he wouldn't usually turn to and that kind of stuff. But that's a great way to look at it. I might practice that this week. The guy that was grieving.
Yeah. The guy that was, yeah, it's a good excuse for all my misdemeanors. I was just a girl who's grieving. What could I do? But I do think, I suppose I said, because now I'm really not a girl, like, you know, and especially I've got 2 kids and if I'm old. Like, I look, and when I see pictures, I'm like, oh God, I was such a child. And that, and I have got, like I said, it's taken a long time, but I definitely look at that person with so much more kindness now. So I just think, oh, what did you know? You didn't know anything. Like, and death, especially when it comes, you know, suddenly, and especially even if, like you said, you might have had experiences or been, you know, close to death in that way, or people you knew had tragic circumstances, but a parent is a whole other world of and losing them. And, you know, some people don't face this till, like, they're in their 50s and their kids are grown up and they're having to deal with this. Like, you are, it is a much younger place to lose that parental figure.
Yeah, you're right. I was trying to think of something really clever to say off the back of that, but I'm just going to agree with everything you said.
I'm sorry. I actually have no counselling training as well, which is like the hilarious thing. I bet counsellors listen like, what's she fucking saying now? Don't say that. That's very bad advice. And I'm like, well, that's what I think, guys, with my English literature degree.
Can you imagine there's like a counsellor's Facebook group against you right now? Can you imagine what she said this week, guys?
Oh, my God.
What a man.
I couldn't believe it. I'm contacting him already. I'm going to offer free counselling after she's finished. I wanted to ask, so when you went for the counselling, how was it? Because you talked earlier about your culture and your background not being so open to emotion. Like, how was it when you changed and you were like, I'm going to be emotional, like with your mum and your friends? Did you sort of, how did people react to that change?
Yeah, I think my mum was a bit worried about me going counselling, just because I think culturally some of the reasons they don't like it is because, you know, in Ghanaian culture, if you go and seek outside help, it shows that you've got like a big issue in your family, which can be like quite embarrassing. Also, you know, the whole idea of like trusting someone with your deepest, darkest, even though counsellors have this code of conduct, maybe my mum thinks that they don't actually stick to it or whatever. But I think, you know, seeing that I was healthier, less snappy, a better communicator, more patient, they just saw the fruit of it, I think, friends and family. And so I think in spite of all the, you know, taboos and the stuff that we've been conditioned to believe about seeking help, they just thought this is good for him, man. And it's helping his grief process, and he's becoming someone that's growing, and, you know, he still has his down days, but on the whole, it's having a really positive impact on him. So I think, yeah, everyone was really happy for me. But I always say, you know, I've had friends that have lost people, and I say, for me, there's not like this 10-point plan of like, yeah, this is how you do it, go counselling, it'll be good. Like, we respond to different things, you know? And also, I think people don't understand sometimes how hard it is for people from poorer communities to have access to stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
I was very privileged in the sense of like, someone just texted me a counsellor's website, and I was able to just book a session for £50 or whatever it was. But like, a lot of people probably would have had to like go to a local authority, NHS, wait for a few months, and this, what do you do in the meantime, and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I was grateful that I could do that. And I always tell people, you just got to try and do what works for you and, you know, what you respond best to.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, I'm a big advocate of counselling, as a counsellor. but I also, I didn't go for a long time. And I think it wasn't right for me at that time. Like, there was, again, part of me that was like, oh, I should have gone earlier. And then part of me like, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to talk about it. So I really hold to that of like, if it is the right thing for you to do, it will come at the right time. And I think it can be really helpful to have it early on. Like, I know Cruise Care are a charity who offer free bereavement. Like, I think they offer like 10 sessions or 6 sessions to literal like grief counselling when something's just happened to you. And I think like that it can be very beneficial to kind of just go, okay, what just happened to me? But then I think, yeah, it's, you said it's so individual and not everybody reacts well to it. And you have to be in the right frame of mind. And I said, the biggest thing is the privilege. You have to be able to think, oh yeah, I can spare that money and that time, which not everyone can.
Yeah, and I can trust this person, etc. But yeah, it was really positive. With my wife, it was interesting because she obviously encouraged me to go, and we went together. And then I was kind of like, oh, babes, there's some things I want to say about you, but I don't think I should say them in front of you. So I might need to go by myself. And she got a bit funny about that. I'm like, well, you told me to go in the first place. But yeah, all in all, it was real positive.
That's a great line. I was like, well, you did get me into it, so now I like it. So you can't really be annoyed at me. I think that's so positive, though. I have to say, like, I mean, obviously, I think marriage counselling or couple counselling is amazing, but I think having the privilege to have a space that's yours, that you get to say whatever you feel like. And, you know, you can be unreasonable. You can say all the unreasonable things. Someone can sort of nod at you and you think, oh, yeah, that's unreasonable, isn't it? Which, if you said out loud to your partner, would be a 3-day row.
Yeah.
And so it's not worth it. But sometimes you just need to say these things. So, yeah, it's helpful. When you were writing the book, how was that sort of... I'm in the middle of writing a book.
Sick. Congratulations.
Thank you.
My glass of water, toasting.
Thank you. But I know from having to write a book in a pandemic, It's tough to go back. Like, did you talk about your dad in the book?
Yeah, I spoke about him a lot. And I think it was because when I had that breakdown in California, I started writing some lyrics about how I felt because I have got the worst memory. Like, oh, it's really? So bad. If I don't write stuff down, I probably would have told you he died in 2013 or something. It's literally that bad. So I guess, you know, starting the book and writing about a third of it was actually really easy because it was just that raw emotion. And I just don't forget how I feel because I wrote it down. And also a lot of stuff came back to me. The tough bit was, where do you go from there? Because I'm not a mental health expert. I'm not a grief expert. I only have my experience to talk about. I don't want to preach at anyone because we all respond to, you know, grief differently. So it's what themes do I pull out? I ended up talking about, you know, working class culture and race and the idea of masculinity and why young men might feel the need to suppress their emotions. And that's the path it took. But yeah, I definitely had writer's block after I wrote about my dad passing away because I was just kind of like, oh, where do we go from here? It's a really short book at the moment.
And it's hard as well because I think when you're you know, that's that story and that narrative of what happened to you is, like you said, you're still replaying it, you're still figuring it out, you're still structuring, like, okay, what happened, when did we get in the car, and do, like, all of that stuff. And writing it down is, yeah, it's so helpful, like you said. I mean, god, my memory of what happened when he died is so foggy now because it's so far it's so far away. I'm always impressed with people who can write down at the time because I can't write down stuff at the time. I find it really difficult.
Yeah, I'm the same. I normally end up doing it because I realise I'm forgetting bits I better do it now. But it was, the good thing about it is I remembered a lot of things because you're just thinking, right, what can I write about him? And things that just seemed like they were nothing actually became really important. Like, he always used to take me to the airport if I was going abroad for a tour or whatever. And that's just like, it's not worth writing about. But actually, it is, because it's like he was the guy that took me to the airport and we shared a lot of great journeys and stuff. And yeah, it just becomes a massive thing now. And stuff that now I want to be the guy that takes people to the airport because my dad did it for me, you know. But yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, I was wondering about that writer's block, because sometimes I tell myself it's writer's block, but really it's like, I can't face thinking about it today, or I can't face writing about it today, you know. And you're like, you sort of like, there's a bit where it's like fun memories, or it's like, oh yeah, this happened. And there's a bit where you have to sort of stop and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
I've just like conjured them up for an hour and now I'm sort of, it's weird. It's not impossible. It's not like so painful I can't do it, but it is, it's bittersweet. It's bittersweet to be like, oh, that was fun.
For sure. I mean, you're writing about and digging up some deep stuff that you can't just forget about when you shut down your laptop, you know. So that is really tough.
Did all that pain end up in lyrics as well? Was that another like place that it went to?
Ended up doing an album. It was called Hands Are Made for Working, because that's something he used to say to me a lot when I was being lazy as a child. And that, I guess that was a big thing for me, because I'm one of these people, which is why I struggle sometimes, that like everything that happens to us in life has to mean something. I think sometimes I overthink it, and sometimes it's just, that doesn't mean anything. That was just some random thing that happened. But with the album and the book, actually, it just felt like there was a bit of purpose to the pain. Like, it's multifunctional, so it's therapeutic for me, firstly, which is why I did it, because it just really helped. But also it can help other people. Might not help everyone, but some people might just be like, oh, I can really relate to that, or this is going to help me when I lose someone. And so I just thought, at least it wasn't all bad. Like, at least there's a bit of good that comes out of it. Like, at least I'm helping some people. At least it resulted in me going to therapy, being a more emotionally healthy person. Like, and I don't want to sound all airy-fairy, because I hate people that always have to like make everything sound rosy. Oh yeah, this is great and stuff, because it was it was crap. But yeah, I'm just like, at least it wasn't all crap. Do you know what I mean?
Oh my god, I mean, yeah, that's why I started the podcast. It's just like, I totally understand that need for something to be not necessarily positive, but like constructive. Like, it doesn't, like you said, oh no, everything's brilliant, but just like something that is like useful to someone, because otherwise you're just left with this feeling of grief. And I definitely, when I started, you know, I was like, oh, maybe this would work. And I just put a few out, and then I might get an email from someone being like, oh, that was really helpful. And I was like, oh, okay. And there's that, like,
yeah,
that feeling of like, oh, being helpful just feels so good after being so out of control and not being able to help in any way. I mean, you can connect it back pretty easily. But I also, and I remember Googling when I started the book, I was like Googling something about grief, and I found this thing that was like, oh, there's like four different types of grieving person. It was like this person. And then the bottom was activist. And it said like, this person will like, you know, use the grief to do something. I was sat there like, you know, and you're like blushing like, oh God, like, they can see me. And it was like, they will like either start researching the disease or set up a charity, or they'll, you know, they feel the need to do something. And I was like, is that bad?
Like, is that it, is have definitely I done something bad?
Me. Yeah.
That's definitely me. But then I get scared because I'm like, are people thinking, oh, can you just stop chatting about grief now, please? Like, we get it, all right? You lost your dad. Chill out, mate.
Well, this is it. Like, I know it's such a sort of double-edged sword of, you're like, well, I want to talk about it and it is helpful, but, oh, I mean, oh God, you know, it's 20 plus years. I feel like, yeah, get over it, carry on. Like, well, still going on about it. You're like,
you say that though, but obviously I'm not just saying this because I'm on your podcast, but I listened to your Charlie McAsee episode and that was really helpful for me in my grief process. I basically just Googled grief podcast and then you came up. So yeah, you know, 20 years on and you're helping someone like me that's gone through it, you know, quite a few years later. So yeah.
Well, I'm sure your book is going to have the same effect. And as you said, like, to be able to talk about it in terms of the culture that you come from, being a man, the working class, all of these things that can affect grief in different ways. Because I think the context of your grief is really important and sometimes ignored. It's sometimes like, oh, grief is this universal thing. It's like, the pain is of like, you know, losing a loved one, but like you said, it all comes with so much other stuff attached to it. So I'm sure your book is definitely going to help people. Well, Isaac, thank you so much for talking to me. It was such a joy, and I just feel it was so nice to speak to you. Thank you.
No, appreciate you having me on your podcast. I feel like a lot of people that come from, you know, the background that I come from can think, oh, stuff like this isn't for me. And so I feel like it's really important that I'm having these conversations with a wide variety of people. And thank you for providing an outlet for me to do that, and something I can text all my mates saying, listen to this, she's all right.
Yeah, that's the helpful thing. If people don't know what to say, or that you're like, or next time someone's like, what happened to you? Like, just listen to the podcast. Like, I did it. I wrote the book, read the book, listen to the podcast.
That's a big thing, you know. Sorry, last thing. No, I talk a lot. But basically, in Ghanaian culture, when someone passes away, the whole family and friends come to the house to pay their respect. So I had about 80 people come to my mum's house the day my dad passed away. And every single time someone comes in, you have to explain what happened again.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, oh, this is so long. So yeah, now I'm just going to send people the podcast.
If only you'd had that on the day.
Yeah, I know, man.
Or like a badge or something. Yeah, 80 people, that's a lot, isn't it? That's a lot to have to go through it again and again. Was it helpful in some ways? Was it like you kind of, or maybe it wasn't. I don't know if it would be helpful to have to keep saying it, or just painful.
Yeah, I think it depends who you are. I would hate that personally, but I think for my mum it was actually quite helpful because, yeah, when she was alone for the first time, I think it was really difficult. Obviously, you have to face that at some point, but it was really helpful for her. But, you know, then I talked to my wife, who's English, and they do things differently. Her family is just like, give them space, like, they'll let you know when you can come around, that kind of stuff. And I think there's pros and cons to both.
Oh yeah, having spoken to so many people, like, some people say stuff, I think, oh, that's good. Oh no, that sounds bad. Like, I think we need to get together and like take the best of everything. I think the Englishness is like, yeah, it's like, oh, give them space. But then some people read that as no one cares. Mm. No one's come around. No one's, oh, it's all like, we'll leave you to it. We don't want to disturb you. And you're like, please don't leave me to it.
Yeah.
I'm so lonely. And this awful thing has happened. But yeah, equally, like what you're saying, like, there's loads of people and you're like, oh my God, there's no space. It's like trying to find that happy medium for it.
Maybe we're onto something there. We've got to try and balance it a little bit. So maybe two people can come around and then we're good.
Yeah, like, or like 80, but like scheduled.
Yeah.
So like they're coming at 11, then they're going, there's a half hour break. Like, yeah, you know, like you do like a press junket and there's like, yeah, then you get like, there's going to be drinks. No one's going to talk to you. You can have a nap. 12 o'clock, I'm afraid we've got 40 people coming at 12, but they're going to be in and out.
Get a red carpet out. Yeah. Auntie Velma coming through at your time. Here we go.
Well, genuinely, thank you so much. It's been such a joy to speak to you and talk about Charles as well. Thank you.
Cheers.
You can follow Governor B on Twitter and Instagram at Governor B. That's G-U-V-N-A-B. And his new book, Unspoken, is available from all good bookshops now. You can follow us at The Griefcast on Twitter and Instagram. The show was edited by Kate Holland. The music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. It was recorded remotely in my living room and I think Isaac's living room as well. Thank you so much to Isaac for taking the time to speak to me. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.